The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement on Federal News Network. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy, trends, innovations, and debates. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Alan Thomas. Alan is the founder and chief strategist at Alpha Tango Strategies, and he's also former commissioner of the Federal Acquisition Service at GSA. Today, we're going to be talking about a host of different topics that are impacting the market, particularly some GSA focus, some more general discussion items in terms of the burdens companies are currently facing. But first of all, Alan, welcome to the show. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
And I know you're very excited about this first topic because it's something that I know you're going to give us a history, but I think, you know, you were there at the inception, and that is we just had the second set, you know, the follow-on contract, second set of awards for the Commercial Platforms Initiative, the e-commerce initiative. The first pilot had three contractors. This new set of awards includes eight companies. It's a milestone for GSA. I think it's a milestone for the program, period, and creates some big opportunities, I think, for government and industry. What are your thoughts on it?
You know, I agree with you. A big milestone for GSA. A long time coming. This was, if you remember, the 2018 NDAA. This was Section 846, championed by Mac Thornberry and my former boss at GSA, Emily Murphy, right, had a hand in that when she was over on the Hill as well. You know, GSA ran a pilot that went for a while and had some spend through there. And then they went to market. And as you said, they made eight awards recently and have just started to kick off the program. It's good to see that the government can actually follow through on these things, right? That there's legislation, that it gets sort of looked at from a policy perspective, right? It gets piloted and then, you know, actually becomes a real viable program. As I said, it took a while, but we got there. I was actually back and forth with a fellow, Kyle Todd at GSA, who sort of has been running the program since inception. And I told him on email, gosh, I remember a snowy January day back in 2018 where we had an industry day on this topic. You were there, Roger, I'm pretty sure. A lot of people there back when people used to gather in person, right? And it's good, just good to see, right, that you can go from that to like, hey, there's a real program and we're gonna really implement this legislation.
Yeah, so the eight companies who received the awards are Amazon Business, E-Procurement Services, Fisher Scientific, Grainger, Noble Supply and Logistics, Pacific Link, Social Glass, and Staples. And that's a good mix of large and small businesses across the board. From your perspective, what you're seeing in the market, I think it's well situated with that number of contractors. I think that's kind of one of the keys to creating the market, a ecosystem where you have a number of companies. I mean, it's like, you know, you have Starbucks on every corner, you know, you have a bunch of companies. It lends something to the program overall. So what is, you think, some of the keys to growing the program from where it is now, which I think is, what is it? It's in the tens of millions of dollars or so on an annual basis to something much more.
I think several of the new awardees will bring pretty significant spend with them right away, right? Several of the awardees that you mentioned there, you know, organizations like a Staples or a Grainger have a .com presence where folks in government with purchase cards are already buying on those platforms, right? So that, I think, you know, they're going to be able to pretty quickly bring some of that spend into the program, assuming GSA kind of turns them loose. And I think you should see some pretty good volume numbers in the program by the end of the first year. I do know that GSA is kind of controlling the rollout of the program, especially when it comes to engaging with agency leadership. So they're not just, they've had sort of a kickoff call with a group call with all the winners, and then I think they're going through and having individual calls with each of the winners as well. And what I've heard out of that is that their GSA's got sort of a deliberate methodical plan to engage agency leadership. They've obviously laid some groundwork already with some of the agency leaders who have agreed to participate in the program. So there might be, the first kind of 90, 120 days, I think they're going to sort of measure twice and cut once. So you might not see huge volumes right at the very beginning, but my guess would be by the end of the 12-month period in the program, you'll see pretty good growth in it. And I do think the mix of vendors is interesting. It'll be interesting to sort of see how it shakes out, right? There are some players in there that don't have a ton of federal government experience. And then there's obviously some big established names in there. So
I think one of the things that I was thinking when you were describing that, I went back to ancient history when I was at GSA. And one of the things, when the schedules program was and the leadership there was trying to grow that program, literally the SESs who were managing the program at the time went to each, chief senior procurement executive and met with them individually to talk about what the program could or couldn't do for them and just what their needs were and how, whether it was a good fit, just kind of, touching the folks, explaining what the opportunities were and understanding agency needs. Is that what GSA is going to be doing, do you think?
I think so. I think they've done some of that already, right? My understanding is there are, some agencies who have committed to participating and then some who have not committed, right? Who are sort of holding back or maybe have even kind of established their own agreements with one of these providers or a provider sort of outside of this, right? An agency like Air Force comes to mind there. But yeah, I think GSA has done some of that spade work, right? To go talk to the senior procurement folks at the agencies, the people who kind of control the government purchase card holders, talk about the value that you get from going through this program versus just sort of, doing something on your own. And there's a little bit of government wide value that's created here when you get more, when you get more spend under management in this kind of way. So I think they've done that. I think it'd be really powerful once they bring the vendors in, right? And the vendors come and show how their solutions can impact in a positive way what's going on at agencies. I think, hopefully there's sort of a flywheel that gets created there, right? And the program just generates a lot of momentum.
Yeah, I think you've touched on something with regard to, the data management piece of it. I think that's sort of an unrealized opportunity there moving forward, because the more spend you get, the more data you get. Correct. To actually get reporting that data, it can help agencies understand and better craft the way they want to go to market, which could be through the platforms or in other avenues. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is credit for small businesses, being purchases under the platform. One of the things that I have consistently heard is there's opportunity there to grow it if you could take credit towards your socioeconomic goals for those individual purchases below $10,000. That's kind of a data, challenge for the government, isn't it? What are your thoughts on that?
It is. I guess what's going to happen here, my understanding is that for some of these small providers, if you're making the purchase through that platform, you're going to get credit, for making a small business buy, right? So yeah, if you total those up in a large organization, that could be pretty significant amount of spend, right? A nice way to accrue some credit towards your small business goals. I will be interested to see if the small platform vendors really can capitalize on that, right? I mean, I'm sure GSA is going to kind of coach them and help them along at the beginning. But I always feel like in things like this, especially when you're unknown to the government purchasing community, you sort of get you get kind of an initial chance, right, to make that impression. The old line, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. If it goes well and people have a good experience, they're likely to come back. If it doesn't, they're going to kind of probably pretty quickly seek other alternatives. So I think this first sort of 6-month period is probably critical for those small businesses who are new entrants into the federal market here.
Right. Well, the other challenge I think is for those platforms where contracting officers or buyers with their credit cards are buying on a platform, and platform's a large business, but the product is from a small business. and being able to get credit for that. That really is a big data challenge, I think.
That is. That is a data challenge, yeah.
But I think that's an opportunity for growth for the program if they can figure that out.
Agreed. Agreed.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know what? We're up at the break, Alan, and I have like one more topic with regard to the e-commerce platforms, and it really focuses around its impact on the GSA Schedules program. We get your take on that, and then we can move on to some other, you know, policy and procurement initiatives. My guest today is Alan Thomas. He's the founder and chief strategist for Alpha Tango Strategies, and he's also former FAS commissioner at GSA. I'm Roger Waldron. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. I'm Roger Waldron. My guest today is Alan Thomas. Alan is the founder and chief strategist for Alpha Tango Strategies. He also was a former commissioner of the Federal Acquisition Service at GSA. And, you know, the first segment, we talked a lot, Alan, about the e-commerce platform. I do have one more question I teed up at the end, and that is really, you know, your thoughts. You were there at the inception of the e-commerce platform. It does, when you do stop and think about it, we're 6 years later, right? 2024. Yeah, that's a nanosecond in government procurement.
A quick 6 years.
I can't believe they did it this fast. I don't know. But anyway, which is a whole other issue. But yeah, I just want to get your take on how you think it fits into the overall, you know, suite of offerings GSA has, and in particular, you know, what's its impact on and, you know, nexus to the GSA Schedules program.
Yeah, so I think, and this is something that we did think about when I was at GSA, and I'm sure they're still thinking about it, right? Look, you want a number of different ways for customers to be able to, you know, to use GSA as a channel to buy things. So this is something that customers were wanting, were clamoring for. So I think it makes sense for GSA to add it to the portfolio. You do have to kind of think carefully, right, about how it fits alongside the Schedules program. You know, I've heard you say, hey, you want, you know, ideally you'd have two healthy programs, right? The Schedules would be a healthy program, which it is, right? More than, I think, $40 billion in volume the last time I looked in a year. So very, very healthy. And you obviously want this new initiative, the commercial platforms program, to be healthy as well. I do think that there's a certain kind of buy, right, that's going to happen through the commercial platforms program that where it kind of makes sense, you know, maybe not to purchase that way through Schedules. But look, a little healthy competition, as long as it doesn't get, you know, kind of destructive, can be good, right? It could push the Schedules program a little bit, right? To think about how to get even more streamlined, right? And you know, do things in a way that works both for government customers and for industry. I will say, when I was there, we did make a decision. This initially was being run out of the IT portfolio, the IT category within the Federal Acquisition Service. And we decided to move the program from a contracting standpoint, and really ultimately from an implementation standpoint, into the general supplies and services portfolio, because we felt like the kind of things being bought in the program really fit in the GS&S portfolio, and it made sense to kind of manage, right, those set of things being bought on Schedule and things being bought through this program in the same portfolio, so you didn't get, you know, what I would call portfolio on portfolio violence at GSA, right? It's one portfolio thinking about how to bring this to market in a coherent way, so you don't confuse customers and you don't confuse yourselves internally either.
Right. Heaven forbid you have portfolio on portfolio violence, right? Or whatever. I mean, because I think back, in analogous is back when, you know, even in the context of the Schedules program, there's, you know, different acquisition centers essentially competing for market share and responsibilities, which can be somewhat healthy, but can also turn, you know, sort of destructive if it's not managed effectively. So one of the things I did, you know, just sort of the next iteration or things that we hear rumblings about at GSA, and that is kind of a, yeah, I guess, for lack of a better way to describe it, an e-commerce platform for services. Do you have any thoughts on that? That's actually been, you know, sort of mentioned by some GSA officials and posited as maybe something they're thinking about moving forward. Do you have any, you know, thoughts or insights on that kind of concept?
think it was always in the back of people's minds. You know, I guess I would say, hey, it took you 6 years to get from, you know, legislation through pilot to actually making some awards. And we've just made awards, right? We're not even really running a full-on program yet. Why don't we, let's run this for a year or two for, you know, what you might essentially call commodities and see how that goes, right? And use any lessons you learn from there to then apply and think about how you might do something like this with respect to services.
I think that's wise, sage advice. That's why you're the chief strategist at Alpha Tango Strategies, Alan. But it's true. I mean, you great minds think alike. I was sort of thinking, why don't you, you know, it's like, it's not ready, fire, aim, right? It's like, let's kind of figure it out a little bit. And I think also the big question will be, what type of services lend themselves to that type of a platform and sort of different buying experience or more streamlined buying experience, perhaps for labor hour type, less complex work? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, look, one of the principal arguments for the commercial platform program when it was put in legislation is people are buying like this in their private lives all the time, right? And they're very comfortable doing it. Hey, I go and buy a pair of shoes or I buy some clothes or, you know, generally commodity things, right? I don't know that there's the same sort of analogy for services, right, in terms of that. So just, it does feel like something to me, just we'd want to think about a little bit more. The case for commercial platforms for commodity type things, super straightforward, right? I'm not saying you can't do it for services. I think you probably can, type of service matters. But I don't know that there are kind of these clear, that there's this sort of clear analogy out there, right, that everyone's comfortable with. So it would be something I'd want to think through a little bit more, maybe, versus how it happened here with the commodities.
Right. And commodities did take 6 years to get where we are, right? So
It did. Yeah. Now, maybe you say, hey, that, and we've learned a bunch of things and we can sort of shorten the cycle on services, you know, okay, great. But again, I'd say, let's get this full on program up running and see some success. Right.
Yes.
And then let's go tackle the next thing.
Okay. And let's tackle the next thing on the show. So the next topic I wanted to discuss with you is GSA just issued some guidance on payment for software licenses delivered as software as a service. And it really goes to what's an advanced payment or not. It'll get real technical, but you know, GSA essentially issued a acquisition letter that provides greater flexibility to purchase or at least pay up front for software as a service. Your thoughts?
I mean, I'm glad they did it. Good news is Jeff Kosis is in that senior procurement executive role, right? And Jeff is always able to come up with creative ways. I think I was reading over the memo. It calls this a specific type of contract financing, right? So it's not an advance payment, right? It's a quote-unquote specific type of contract financing. And so it's not prohibited by the advance payment statute. I mean, look, it's really a reflection of how business is being done in the commercial world. And however you got to sort of massage the language to get it done, I think it's good that they got it done. If you're a small SaaS provider, either working in government or thinking about coming into government, and you didn't think you could sort of get paid coincident with when you flip on the subscription for a customer, that could be a huge deterrent to entering the market. So I'm glad that the team at GSA put that out and clarified that. It's actually not a bad time to be a SaaS vendor, right? If you read the draft FedRAMP memo that came out in, I guess it was November-ish of last year, and that from what I hear is likely to come final here pretty soon, there are a number of things in there that are going to be good for SaaS providers, particularly small SaaS providers also, to help them get in, enter the government market, and serve government customers. I mean, it's good for those providers. It's obviously good for agency buyers and folks who have a mission also, right? Who are trying to use those solutions to achieve some result. So it's a good, the government, I think, is doing the right, you know, trying to, and in many cases, doing the right thing for SaaS vendors, again, especially small SaaS vendors. And it's an important part of the market. It's a growing part of the market with a lot of innovation happening.
Yeah, and I think your point, you were right on point when you mentioned it's consistent with commercial practice. I think, and then Jeff kind of gets it, like the more you can mirror commercial practices and federal procurement, federal buying patterns, the more efficient it's going to be, the more cost effective it's going to be, because you know, companies aren't altering their practices, which increases cost to them, which increases prices to the government. Truly is about leveraging that commercial market. And there's a lot going on in that regard in terms of, you know, the layering on of rules and regulations. And I know we're about to take the break, but when we come back, we'll continue our discussion. And one of the things we're going to focus on in the next segment is, you know, the continuing growth of regulations, the complexity of those regulations, and the impact on the industrial base. My guest today is Alan Thomas. He's the founder and chief strategist for Alpha Tango Strategies. He's also a former commissioner of the Federal Acquisition Service at GSA. I'm Roger Waldron, listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. I'm Roger Waldron. My guest today is Alan Thomas. He is the founder and chief strategist for Alpha Tango Strategies. He's former commissioner of the Federal Acquisition Service at GSA. And we're talking about the federal market. In this segment, we touched on it just very briefly, almost alluded to it at the end of the last segment, and that's just the growing volume, complexity, layering on of regulations and requirements for government contractors, and what does it mean for the market? Alan, I know this is something that's you're very concerned about. Just your thoughts.
Well, I think you mentioned the volume and complexity. It feels unprecedented. I mean, I had talked to a senior executive in a policy role in an agency who said, he's been at this a while. He said, look, this is unprecedented, right? The amount of policy and regulatory activity that the government's having to deal with, and that ultimately industry has to deal with, is pretty significant right now. And I think from my standpoint, just the issue is, right, on one hand, the government, federal government will always say, look, we want to be open to new vendors. We want to encourage new vendors and innovation. Come in, right? These are some of the most important missions happening in this country, right? Serving the federal government, making sure we've got the best tools in people's hands to get done what they need to get done. So that we're saying that on one hand. On the other hand, we're putting in place all kinds of additional rules and regulations, which if you're a new entrant, look pretty daunting and, might make you think that it's not worth it for you to enter that market, right? And that, that could ultimately choke off innovation. It's great if you're already inside the castle and the moat's getting wider and deeper. That's great, right? You're probably just fine with that, right? But if you're not, then the moat looks like maybe it's not even worth trying to cross it. And any one of these things individually makes sense, right? When we could take a specific FAR case or an OMB memo or a component of something, right? Individually, they all make sense, but sort of the collective weight and burden that those things place on industry, I do think isn't something that government always thinks about, right? I don't know if anyone's kind of holistically thinking about all the burden that each individual, rule or regulation entails.
Well, there's been, GAO's done reports, Bloomberg's done studies, and it's clear from all these folks that the industrial base serving the federal government has shrunk over the last 10 to 15 years and continues to shrink. And that's especially true in the defense industrial base and particularly small businesses. And when you talk to people about it, they acknowledge it, but nobody's thinking about any kind of solutions. And in the meantime, and I know this is one thing that we talked about before the show that I would give you an opportunity to talk about. In the meantime, layering on of all kinds of requirements, and they may be very important, but how are you going about it? And I think particularly about all the different aspects of cyber. So your take on that.
Well, yeah. I mean, and the requirements, and we've talked about this a little bit, the requirements tend to be process focused, right? So they're not, sometimes if you tell somebody the outcome you're looking to achieve, they might come up with a fairly elegant way for, at least for them, to achieve that outcome. Everyone's happy, right? But if you sort of tell them, this is the process that we need you to follow, it feels good from a, whoever's building that, right? And putting that out, that they feel like, yes, I'm gonna get the results I want. Not necessarily, right? Because of some unintended consequences sometimes, but from an industry standpoint, you feel like, there's not a lot of flexibility for me here. And again, if you're a new entrant who doesn't sort of have the infrastructure built up to kind of receive, understand, and put some of these regulation and policy into practice in your business, that can be daunting, right? And it just, you know, it feels like, as you said, the industrial base getting smaller, particularly the defense industrial base, you know, that's an area where they're really trying to drive a lot of innovation and encourage all kinds of new players to get into the market. And even, I mean, ideally, right, we love businesses that are, that have a commercial component and that also do some work with the government, right? We don't want to sort of create firms that are just ultimately relying on the government, right? And if you want to drive innovation, right, I think you really need firms that have that connection out to the commercial market also. So again, the more we create kind of a separate ecosystem with a bunch of additional rules and regulations, I think the tougher it is to kind of maintain that, that sort of industrial base that we want.
Yeah, along those lines, just, I thought you made it, it was a great analogy. You talked about the cyber requirements and whether they're, you know, the various ones, whether it's CMMC, the FAR cyber incident rule, agency specific cyber incident reporting rules, the software attestation from CISA, just a host of different, the FedRAMP, all these things. And you characterize it, are these a group of separate stories that are compiled in a book or separate editorials, let's say, or is it a story with individual chapters that flow together? Just expand on that a little bit. I thought it was a great analogy.
Yeah, well, from an industry standpoint, right, you would hope that it's a book, right, that has a kind of beginning, middle, and end, and these, each of these things are a series of chapters, right, or components of chapters in a book, and that kind of makes up a story versus sort of a bunch of individual short stories that aren't necessarily connected in any way, except that they happen to come from the government, right? I think, I mean, it's always been a question of mine. I mean, you know, maybe it's an OMB function, maybe it's a function somewhere in the White House, but is there somebody who's thinking about these things in a holistic sense, right? And looking at them and how they fit together and what they're ultimately trying to achieve. As I said earlier, individually, each of these things makes sense, right? You take a specific FAR case, you look at it, you read it, and say, why are we doing this? You know what? That does make sense, right? But does it still make sense when you look at 6, 7, 8 other things that are being done, right? The kind of totality of that, where's that holistic look coming from, right? And I'm sure there are, you know, smart, dedicated public servants out there who are thinking about this. I don't get a sense, though, that there's one place where that's really being done, right? And being thought through to the fullest extent possible. Even, you know, how do you sequence these things out from a timing standpoint, all those sorts of things. It's not clear to me that there's kind of a coherent plan or story there around these things.
Yeah, and the implications, again, for the industrial base, just in terms of the amount of work folks will have to do to, number one, understand the requirements, and then, to a certain extent, implement those requirements. And then if the requirements differ from differing regulations, whether it's as far as cyber incident rules, it talks about, you know, 8-hour notification, if I recall correctly, versus the DFARS rule that gives you, you know, significant amount more time. You know, what's a company to do? I guess you got to manage to the shortest default number, but you still have to understand your obligations under different contracts. That's why folks are doing OTAs. What do you think?
Yeah, right. Looking potentially for ways around some of these things, right? Or feeling like they've got to hire a bunch of lawyers to help them figure it out, right? Which sometimes you do need to hire lawyers to help you figure things out. But to the extent that becomes the answer for a lot of this, again, those costs get borne by the government, by the taxpayer at the end of the day. So it's an issue. I mean, I think particularly in a big, broad area like cyber, people feel like, hey, there are huge threats out there. We're kind of constantly under attack. Maybe we're playing a little bit of defense there, playing from behind a little bit. So you want to take action and do things and, you know, put procedures in place, put new rules and regulations in place. All makes sense, but you just have to be really, I think, really thoughtful about it and do it in a kind of coherent way, again, so that it's a story that makes sense, right? And not a series of kind of one-offs, right? That when you pull them all together, you say, oh, that actually isn't a coherent story, right? It's just a whole lot of extra things for industry to try and keep tabs on.
Well, you know, I think a coherent sort of approach also enhances the, you know, effective, you know, a certain sense compliance, or, you know, the government's being able to better protect if they understand you know, what the obligations are more, you know, in a clear, concise sort of way. So that's a good point. And nobody's saying, hey, people are going to use OTAs to avoid cyber requirements. Those requirements will still be there, but OTAs are not FAR-based transactions. So a lot of things don't apply, and they're much more of a commercial nature to them. So even though there are still going to be some unique things, it's still a streamlined process that increasingly makes sense to the government and to industry as well. And that is kind of a comment on the FAR, I think.
I think you're right, which turned 40 this year.
Yeah, I think I wrote a blog about that.
Did you? Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, so, but we're up on the breakout. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion. You know, and I also will definitely want to get your take on the Final Four this year, the NCAA tournament. We'll do that at the end of the segment and get your thoughts. I know you're a big basketball guy. My guest today is Alan Thomas. He is the founder and chief strategist at Alpha Tango Strategies and former FAS commissioner at GSA. I'm Roger Waldron. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. I'm Roger Waldron. My guest today is Alan Thomas. Alan is the founder and chief strategist at Alpha Tango Strategies. He also is also the former commissioner of the Federal Acquisition Service at GSA. And we're talking about lots of procurement issues, what's going on, shaping the market. And, you know, this segment, you know, so we talked about like a lot of the burdens and where those are. I think the next step for conversations with folks is, okay, what do you want to eliminate? But that could be a series of shows. So let's talk about what's going on, what's opportunities in the market too, and in particular in interagency contracting. And I would say this year is the year of interagency contracting in a lot of ways. So let's just run through them. We have, or you can run through them, Alan. What are all the procurements that are either going on or in final stage or in acquisition planning right now, the big ones that cross agencies?
Well, we've got OASIS Plus, right, which is teed up to make some awards here, probably, you know, thousands of awards, potentially.
Yes.
lots of awards there. And I know you like that program name also. You wanted to stay true to the original branding, right? So they didn't stray far with version two there. Polaris also, right, over in the IT category, the follow-on to Alliance Small Business, that, you know, looks like it's moving along smartly. Also, you should see some activity there this year, which is good. That's a long saga. Alliance Small Business was a very, very successful vehicle. So it'd be good to see GSA get a successor vehicle to market there. Alliant 3 on the unrestricted side, still kind of early days, although people are definitely preparing and thinking about that one. Obviously an important, you know, an important vehicle. There's a BPA around cloud, infrastructure service, platform as a service, and the professional services around that called Ascend, which has been a little while in the planning, but it feels like they're getting closer there too. There have been some drafts released and industry days held, and at some point that's got to get to market, or, you know, cloud will be old news, right? So better get
quick. So let me ask you a question about that one in particular, Alan. And it's just sort of like one of the things that industry clearly has articulated is that where are the customers? What are the requirements that are committed to the vehicle? And it really is just basic business. They want to understand what their return on investment for bid and proposal and competing for it is going to be, or is potentially there for them. Otherwise, they have, you know, the folks who run the procurements on behalf of the companies, they have to go to their management and ask, you know, to make that investment. And management wants to know, okay, what's our return? And is GSA, and one of the things we haven't really gotten a clear answer on is, well, who is going to use it? Is that something that you experienced when you were there, or just how that was handled, or you have any insights just on where they're going with it?
So it's certainly a fair question. I mean, there is an internal business process at GSA when you want to put something like this together, right? Because it takes, you know, time and effort and commitment of GSA resources to do it. So the obvious question, you know, from an executive in GSA is, well, does it make sense to do it? Is there a market for it, right? Or, you know, are we going to be able to drive volume through it that would justify investing and putting something together. So, you know, they've gone through that process. I will say I did relay that some of that feedback to an executive at GSA around this procurement in particular. Hey, it would be good to share with industry some insight on the pipeline of agencies and opportunities that you see coming through this BPA, right? That would help the folks in industry get the right resources lined up to be able to bid on it. And then obviously, drive work to it, right? Go out and talk to customers about it and drive work to it. So I'm hopeful that will be done, that industry does get, you know, a little bit of a clearer picture. It can be hard when you start something new, right? If it's a follow-on, you know, Oasis Plus or Alliant 3, people say, oh, I have some sense. There's a bunch of requirements that were competed in there in the past. Many of those are likely to show up again. And the program kind of has a track record of, you know, working with customers and driving volume to those vehicles. When you start something new, you don't have that reservoir of trust, if you will, and that, you know, that kind of backlog of recompetes that are likely to come through again. So it's, I do think it's kind of extra important to communicate that out to industry and give them some sense that the effort of bidding on it and winning it is going to be worth it, right? You're going to see the deals, you're going to see the volume come through there.
Yeah. So I just, in your thoughts on, so, you know, there's NASA SEWP, which is in the planning process, and, you know, they're working towards a final RFP. Don't know the exact timing on that. But then CISP-4, the procurement that, you know, I don't know what's the right term, will not conceive. Maybe that's the right word. They can't get to the finish line with all the protests and everything. You know, what are you hearing about that particular procurement, or, you know, just the, you know, frustrations from industry?
Yeah, I think on CISP-4, unfortunately, it just draws a chuckle from people at this point, right? But it's sort of a resigned chuckle, right? Because it's like, you know, how can this be? And this is something I think to look at across the board on these government-wide vehicles is, you know, have we gotten to a point where they become so important, businesses view them as so important that if you don't get a seat at the table, you're willing to kind of protest and essentially jam up the works for everybody for, you know, look, and as you said on CISP-4, you know, it's been a couple of years. It calls into question all kinds of other things also. You know, people bid, in this case, they bid rates, for example, in this, right? I mean, there's all sorts of things, right, that, you know, 2 years, you know, business is fluid, right, and dynamic. And two years ago, you might not want to commit to that now, right?
Right. Well, labor goes up. You know, people get paid more every year, right?
So
those rates will go. That's a great point. So, and now we only got about a minute left. So I wanted to get your take on the Final Four. You know, UConn repeating as champions. I know you're a big basketball guy, as am I. You know, just how you think it turned out.
I think it was a great year for college basketball. I would start on the women's side, right? Because I will tell you, I think I watched more women's basketball this year than I did men's basketball. And I will note that the Iowa South Carolina final on the women's side outdrew, from a ratings perspective, the UConn Purdue final on the men's side. But I thought both Final Fours were great. The storylines were great. I thought they were a little bit stronger. The storylines obviously were a little stronger on the women's side. Caitlin Clark, generational player, right, with just all kinds of appeal. So super cool to see that on the women's side. And the men's side, I know you like post-play, right? It was kind of cool to see in the final two seven-footers, right? Two, as the late, great Al McGuire, right, used to call
them aircraft carriers.
That's right, aircraft carrier. Two aircraft carriers, right? So that was kind of fun and a throwback there. It was interesting. It tells you how much the game has changed, right? 30 or 40 years ago, if you'd said, hey, the national player of the year is a seven-footer, Zach Edey, in this case, went off for 35 points or whatever he had in the final, you would have said, oh, I bet his team won, right? And they didn't, right? They only shot 1 for 7 from three-point land, and they didn't win. So anyways, it was yeah, it was a fun year on both sides, both in the men's tournament and the women's tournament.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, Caitlin Clark is an amazing player, amazing. But South Carolina is an amazing team that play great defense. That's just, you know, I mean, they're just so good. It's just so, I mean, I thought South Carolina was going to win. I mean, just because they were just so solid a team, so defensively solid. And just their all-around play, they have lots of players, right? A little bit deeper than Iowa.
No doubt. 37-0 on bench points, right? They remind me, South Carolina reminds me of the Georgetown men's teams in the 80s under John Thompson, right? Where they just had waves of great athletes that came out with a coach who know how to coach some defense, right?
Right. You know, that's – yeah, those Georgetown teams are some of my favorite college teams. On the men's side, I would say that Connecticut is one of the best teams I've seen in a long, long time. The offense that they run and the adjustments they make in that offense during even the course of the game, switching out who sets the picks to get Castle on pick and rolls as opposed to him handling the ball on those, and just an amazing, amazing team. And their game plan, you know, let the big guy get his points and shut down all the frees. I don't even know if Edie had an assist or not. I can't recall. But he's, you know, and that's a big part of their game is, you know, getting it into him and then kicking it out for a three. And they just couldn't find a way to get open for those threes in any event. So it was amazing games. And the last thing I'll say is just shout out to Alabama, where my kids have gone to school. A great run. So glad Nate Oates is staying and not heading off to Kentucky, and looking forward to the, you know, what Alabama can do in the future. And with that, you know, we've done our sports thing. So I appreciate it, Alan. And I want to thank my guest today, Alan Thomas. He's a founder and chief strategist at Alpha Tango Strategies. And I'm Roger Walden. You've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement on Federal News Network. Tune in Tuesday mornings at 11 or subscribe to this show on iTunes or Podcast One.